refrain of creed. Zionism, a-Zionism, and anti-Zionism. Before we start, I want to once again thank Rabbi Grover and thank the Tikva for making the opportunity available. I also wanted to note there are flyers for the on the table. I have a 3-4 week mini-series starting this Wednesday, Jewish Bioethics from Birth to Death, and that'll be over at Beth Emmet, and you can see all the details on the flyer over there. And where's Diane? There you are. I knew it would be Diane, who was kind enough to give me this to represent the anti-Zionism, a lovely picture of two Hasidic-looking fellows with Palestine and Talitos. Yeah. Okay, then, because it takes all kinds. So, last time, we wrapped up our discussion of Zionism and started on the discussion of a-Zionism, and I realized that I actually veered a little bit from the plan. I wanted to go back to it, because I said at the beginning that we're going to be talking about not just these ideas, whether Zionist or non-Zionist or anti-Zionist, but that we'll be tracing their biblical roots. Where all these come from, when they come. And I realized that as I went through the a-Zionist arguments, I didn't show for all of them how they're actually Tanakh-based. And so if you have the sheets, and there are more over there by the hot water, two sources that I should have brought last time, one of the motivations that we mentioned for those who are a-Zionists, those who do not believe that there should be a state, but on the other hand, don't oppose the move to create a Jewish state. One of the motivations was the fear of false messiahs, that they're afraid that people are going to buy into the idea that a return of Tzion, the creation of the state, is a sign that the messiah is here. So, if you take a look at your first source, I wanted to just show you a little bit of why historically Jews have been afraid of false messiahs. Meaning, what's wrong with a false messiah? I mean, you could make the argument that what's wrong with false messiah is that it's false. Messiah is not. You could also make the argument that it gives people this hope that then is dashed, and that's destructive in its own right. But fundamentally, one of the biblical concerns with false messiahs was they didn't tell you to do anything. Right? If you remember the story of Shabbatai Tzvi, which we mentioned last week, we're going to go into, Shabbatai Tzvi at one point converts to Islam. Right? A false messiah didn't say anything. So take a look at source number one, where you find this in the book of Malachi, the book of Kings, where there is an attempt to make an alliance between Yehuda and Israel. Remember that after the time of King Solomon, the Jewish nation that is in Israel splits into two parts. You have the 10 tribes in the north, they become the kingdom of Israel, Israel, and 2 tribes in the south, those become Yehuda, Judea. So there's an attempt at making an alliance between the two to go to war. And Yehoshaphat is number one. Yehoshaphat, Jehoshaphat, but I chose to leave it as Yehoshaphat, says to the king of Israel, Yehoshaphat is the king of Judea in the south, he says to the king of Israel in the north, seek now today the word of God. Should we in fact go to war or not? And the king of Israel gathered the prophets, about 400 men, and he said to them, shall I go to Ramoth-Gilead to war or refrain? And they said, ascend, and God will give it into the hands of the king. They are false prophets. They're saying what they think the king wants to hear. And the result is calamity. So that's one reason for the a-Zionists, and that's one biblical root for their positions. The other one was that we said that one of the a-Zionist arguments is when you come to the land, it's hard to observe all the commandments that apply within the land of Israel. And I've already given source number two, a verse we're going to revisit later, which speaks of what will happen in the event that the Jews come back to the land, but they don't observe the commandments. And you can see it describes the land vomiting you out. Kind of graphic, I apologize. But that's the verse, sorry. Oh, Taki. Well, Taki is an anonymous, right? Well, Taki is Taman. Yeah. No, that's why I translated it that way. I would have been as graphic if it wasn't the actual, you know, right word. Okay. We are not meant to try to push things until the until it comes from God. So for some, that just leads to non-science. That leads them to say, okay, so I won't push for there to be a sin. It doesn't even bother me if there is a sin. However, the anti-Zionists latch on to this. Take a look, please, on your sheet. Excuse me. And source number three. Source number three comes from a handy website you should never visit. It is the website of Nitori Karta USA. Nitori Karta literally means what? Anybody know? People of Palestinian, Palestinian. No, the words themselves. Nitori Karta is an Aramaic phrase. We're going to see its origin in a little bit. Leading toward to be no terror. You got it. All right, it's a city. You were going to say keepers of the city? Somebody was. You got it. So noter is to guard. Sometimes that's negative, sometimes it's positive. So for example, when the Torah gives its command not to bear a grudge, right? Not to guard any grudge. Lo tikom means don't take revenge. Velo titor. And do not guard means to guard a grudge. Et benamah, against your people. So Nature means guardians, and Karta is a city or a place. So Nature Karta, they fancy themselves to be the guardians of the land of Israel. That's the way they style themselves. Well, take a look at source number three. Talking about the idea that it's up to God to decide when the Messiah will come, it's up to God to decide when we get to return to the land. Whoever calls this the salvation of Israel shows that he denies the essence of the people of Israel and substitutes another nature, a worldly materialistic nature, and therefore sets before them a worldly materialistic salvation, and he quotes, and the means of achieving this salvation is also worldly and materialistic, i.e. to organize a land and army. As far as they are concerned, human attempts to set up a state in the land of Israel, to set up an army, to set up a government, and so on, are materialistic and inappropriate, and for them, that is a basis for being anti-Zionist. Now, religious Zionism has response to this. Anyone bring this argument of you're not supposed to bring the Messiah without showing the other side of it. Meaning, we could be left with the impression that there's nothing to say in response. That since the Talmud says, we saw it last time, that God makes us swear three oaths that are represented in Shirat Shirim, in Song of Songs, we are sworn not to awaken the love of God before it is time, that therefore we're actually coming back, creating a state. However, there are responses, and I brought you one response in particular because I find it particularly fascinating. The oaths that we presented last week were recorded in the Talmud, and there were three of them. One of the oaths was that we should not ascend to the land of Israel in force, as a wall. Shalom Yahu Bechoma. So take a look at source number four. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who was a leading rabbi in Israel until he passed away in 2003, says the following. The oath against ascending in mass means that we shall not go up at once by force, as Rashi explained on the Talmud. If so, that only applied before we received the great mandate, meaning from the UN. For that great ascent could have been viewed by the many monarchs who reigned over us as ascending by force in mass. In truth, there were laws prohibiting that under threat of execution. We remember well the tragic events which occurred under the mandate, to the sparks saved from the fire where they appeared to be ascending in mass. But he's talking about what happened to Jews who tried to enter Israel to flee from the Holocaust and the way that they were turned away. But then he says, from the time God remembered us though to give us a name and a sovereign portion in his holy land, and God planted in the hearts of the United Nations, like Cyrus in his time, to return the stolen part of our land, that the gates of the land were open wide day and night, and would not be closed before any Jew, without restriction, without limits, and all would be accepted with open arms and a soul felt of joy. So the oath against descent in mass is no longer at all relevant. Its strength is gone, since no one will see this as ascending in force. itself, the mitzvah of Aliyah is renewed, but also as a general obligation upon the entire house of Israel and upon every group of Jews in any of the exiles to arise and gather itself and come settle in the land of our desire. You see his argument? He says, there was an oath not to take it by force. We didn't take it by force. The UN broke it. Whatever possessed them to actually agree, they agreed. And therefore, there's no problem with revokes. That's his response. That's one response. There's another response, which some people actually, I think, started to mention last week. We said that one of the oaths was that we should not ascend in force. But there was also an oath for the nations of the world, that they should not harm us too much. We think they already done that. And therefore, just like they broke their oath, our oath is no longer binding. It's a mutual agreement. And I bring the Midrash, which supports that. I'll explain that slide of the text of the Midrash. There was a pact that was made, going back to biblical times, with the people of Moab, that we were not supposed to go fight a war against Moab. In the time of King David, however, we find him going to war against there was a pact with Moab, there's another pact that no, but we find David going to war. And the Midrash asks, how is it that he's able to do it? And the answer is because they attacked us first. And since they attacked us first, our responsibility not to fight with them is defeated. It's not even a matter of us. They attacked us, so therefore we are no longer bound by this treaty that we're not going to attack them. So that's another argument. Just wrapping up from last time, in terms of the issue of saying maybe we shouldn't be going back, we shouldn't be pushing it, religious Zionism has a response to that. But now let's get to the last category, and that is anti-Zionism. And I have to say, I'm really torn when it comes to this part of our series, because I don't really want to make a good case for it. So I'm giving you a disclaimer right now, which is, everything I'm about to say is within their point of view. This is not my point of view. I will probably have to reiterate that a bunch of times. There are basically four arguments held up by the, four, maybe five arguments, of those who say that it's wrong to have Zionism, and that in fact, it should be protested against, and Jews should be fighting against the Zionist agenda. The first of the five is the one that we've already seen a little bit of. I brought you source number six, which is the one that says we're not allowed to return. We've already seen this source. My Samson Rachel Hirsch was of that camp who said, we're not supposed to return early, and I'm only bringing it again because in the last line where he writes, it's this idea that it's for God to do this. It forbids us to strive for the reunion or possession of the land by any but spiritual means. So it's forbidden. It's something that we are not allowed to pursue. And that's one approach. There's a second approach, though, that is anti-Zionist, and it is pragmatic. It's a practical approach, also a biblical approach. And this is the approach that says it's really dangerous for Jews to concentrate their population in the land of Israel. It makes us vulnerable. And it's true. Let's not kid ourselves, right? In 1973, if those wars go the other way, it's the end of world Jewry in many ways. And yes, they were Jews still living outside of the land of Israel, understood. But that large population, the Iranians having a nuclear bomb potentially, and thinking to themselves, you know, we can do the world Jewry just by watching one. So that's a second argument that's attributed to the Sadhu Rebbe, who we're going to be hearing a lot of this morning. And it's the view that says this is too much of a threat. It's too much of a danger. Now, the Zionists in response say, you know, God is going to protect us. God is going to take care of us. We come back to the land, and then 7, and this is the biblical root for this element of this argument of anti-Zionism. Jeremiah warns the Jewish people, do not trust the false words which say, it is the sanctuary of God, the sanctuary of God, the sanctuary of God, but only improve your ways and deeds, performing justice between parties, etc. Jeremiah is speaking to the Jews at the end of the First Temple period. And Jeremiah is known for the fact that he spends almost his entire book warning them, the temple is going to be destroyed, you are going to be exiled, you better start doing things that are good in order to survive. And a lot of people don't want to listen to him. Well, not a lot of people, none of the people want to listen to him. And no one is listening to him. And there's a camp that says, it's never going to happen. Yes, God warns and warns and warns, but come on, it's his temple. He's not going to destroy it. And Jeremiah says, think carefully, because you have no such commitment. And in fact, it's a matter of decades before it is destroyed, and the Jews are sent into exile. And so, the Sapphire look at this and say, you think you're going to be safe in the land? You think you're going to bring millions and millions of Jews to live in the land? And just because it's the land of Israel, you're going to be safe? Remember the words of Jeremiah, nothing is safe. If you will follow God, then fine. Otherwise, no. Diane.
What about performing justice between parties? Is that just their mandate that they need to try and create justice between all the people of Israel?
So Diane asks, what happens to the rest of Jeremiah's sentence? Right? Jeremiah said that you shouldn't rely on being the sanctuary of God. You should improve your ways and deeds. You should perform justice between parties, take care of the widow and the orphan, and so on. So that is correct, but here's something that I think is very, very important, because it gets lost. And here I'm not speaking about the Torah character per se, but about Sapphire in general. We have a tendency to read the worst into those we disagree with. We have a tendency, and it's a human tendency, to criminalize, or even to demonize, people with whom we disagree, and to say, not only are they guilty of this sin, they're guilty of a whole bunch of other sins as well. And that happens regarding the Sapphire. Meaning to say, these are the people who are anti the state of Israel, these are the people who, as we're going to read, talk about how they hate the Zionists, and they hate the idea, and everything else, and therefore assume they're also guilty of not performing justice between parties and so on. The truth of the matter is, among the Jewish people, I can't say among the world because I haven't traveled, but among the Jewish people, the most kind and benevolent people in terms of reaching out to help others in need, believe it or not, are the Sapphire. The Sapphire are the ones in their areas where they live. You don't see it if you're outside of their communities. But they are the ones who go into the hospitals, they go into the prisons, they go into the old age homes, they go into all the different areas and help people regardless. They'll get them kosher food, they'll let people visit them, and so on, regardless of whether they're sour or not. So it's very important to keep that in mind as we go through this. I'm not saying that they're not. I think enough said on that. So we have two factors so far. Factor number one, it's not for us to trigger the Messiah. We're not supposed to do it until the right time. But God says it's the right time. Factor number two, the Zionism is dangerous. They're concentrating Jews in an area where they can be harmed. Factor number three, though, is one that's very striking. And that is, as I wrote on your sheet, disapproval of admiration of the state. They don't like the idea of Jews looking up to and admiring the success of the IDF, the success of Israeli technological innovation, the success of the government, although they don't have much to worry about on that one. The other two, it's kind of pretty bad. I don't know if there are countries in the world that look up to the Knesset as a model of governments. That could just be Jews talking about Jews. So maybe the rest of the world thinks it does not. Maybe. But take a look at source number three. who took you out of Egypt from the house of slaves, who brought you through this vast and frightening wilderness, snakes and venomous snakes and scorpions and waterless thirst and warm water from the stone for you, who fed you manna in the wilderness that your ancestors did not, to make you suffer and to test you, to benefit you in the end. And you will say in your hearts, my strength and the might of my hand created all of this wealth for me. That's the key phrase. My strength and the might of my hand. Anyone know the Hebrew? There are a couple of Hebrew speakers that know. Kochi v'otzem yadi. My strength and the might of my hand created all of this wealth for me. That's the warning the Jews received before entering the land. And it was so that you could basically bring the entire book of Deuteronomy on this sheet in order to show this. As they showed up over and over again, the Jews are told, you know, you're coming into a land where there are houses already built. You didn't build them. You're coming to a land that has orchards and that has fields that you didn't plant. Don't think that you did this yourself. Yeah. Sorry? Well, yes, it can lead to idolatry, but more, right? It's self-worship. Right? The feeling of, I'm the one who did all of this. Yes?
Doesn't that warning apply equally to our diasporas?
Oh, doesn't that warning apply equally to the diaspora? What do you think?
We all feel very comfortable here.
Absolutely true. We feel comfortable here. Absolutely. It can apply to anybody at any stage of life in any part of the world. Nonetheless, when it's your land, right, which you control, which identify with you, there's undoubtedly a bigger risk. Because when I'm here, there's always the risk of somebody attacking a synagogue. There's always the risk of somebody reminding Jews, you're not of us. When it's your land, it's a lot easier to become arrogant. So we're hands here, yes? Good, thank you for asking that question. The question then is, a lot of these people live in the land of Israel and receive government funding. If you don't believe in it, why are you taking the cash? To which the answer is a lot of them knows. Meaning, it's true that there are, this is one of those areas where you need to distinguish between groups. There are those who are anti-government, will not vote in the elections, will not participate at all. We'll still be glad to take the child's credits, and we'll still be glad to get government support. However, if I understand correctly, the Jewish character will not take money from the government. My Jews are still benefiting. They're still driving on the roads.
They're still living there.
They're still living there, right?
They have all the benefits of living in a Jewish state, whether it's a Jewish state that they want.
Correct.
It is a Jewish state.
Correct.
And they live there. How? I was baffled by them a long time ago, but I'm truly baffled now. I don't understand how that dichotomy of thought can be put together even by them.
I mean, you can easily give their response. No. Their response will be, we are living here in order to work against this government. That will be their response. We are doing this in order to sabotage the idea of all of this. Some of them live in Montreal. They come here to Toronto to walk with Israel. They don't live in Toronto, very close. But it's good. If I actually have something to explore. But the truth of the matter is that they view themselves as people who are trying to work against the state, even as they live there. Right, so I don't know the song, so.
Oh, it's a very, very famous song. It's an age, no color, like,
right.
We didn't have a miracle, we didn't find
a list. Right, and I'm going to come back to that just in another couple of minutes. So keep that in mind, because it's very true. I can give you another example from later on in the book of Deuteronomy, another classic verse. And Yishurun. Yishurun is a reference to the Jewish people. And it's a prediction of what will happen. Yishurun became fat and kicked his work in the past tense, as though it has happened already. woman also engages in political marriages with women from other cultures who bring their idolatry right there into the palace. And Solomon himself is condemned for it. And then you find a later king who modeled himself on Solomon, a man by the name of Uzziah. Uzziah was not as well known as Solomon, but he models himself on Solomon. This is later in Jewish history. This is when Yehuda and Israel, Judea and Israel have already separated. He is the king of Judea in the south. Coming in after a time when Judea has been in decline, he manages to reverse it. He engages in wars of conquest. He builds up the land. He builds infrastructure. Take a look, please, at source number 11. This is describing the acts of King Uzziah. And he went forth, number 10 first. This describes his righteousness from the book of Kings 2, Lachim Beth. And Uzziah did that which was righteous in God's eyes according to all that his father Uzziah did. Only the altars were not removed. The nation still slaughtered and burned incense on the altars. So Uzziah was good. He's trying to do the right thing. Among the nation, there are still Jews who are worshiping idols, but it sounds like he's a good king. So far, so good. Right? We like Uzziah at this point. Yeah, but that's the people, that's not him. Then take a look at number 11. He went to work and he warred against the Plishtim, the Philistines, and broke down the wall of Gath, and the wall of Yavneh, the wall of Ashdod. These are all cities occupied by the Philistines in his day. He built cities about Ashdod and among the Plishtim, and God helped him against the Plishtim and against the Harim who dwelt in Rubal and the Unim. And the Unim rendered tribute to Uzziah. His name spread abroad to the engines of Mitzrayim of Egypt, for he strengthened himself exceedingly. Moreover, Uzziah built towers in Jerusalem. Some of you know this song, but you know it in the Hebrew. But even Uzziah will be the new shrine, right? That's this one. Uzziah built towers in Jerusalem at the center of the corner gate and at the valley gate and at the angle of the wall and fortified them. And he built towers in the desert and dug many wells, for he had much cattle, both in the lowland and in the plains. He had farmers and vine dressers, I don't know what that means, in the mountains. What are vine dressers? They take care of the grapes, right? I would think so. And the Carmel, for he loved the soil. Who modeled himself on Uzziah in the 20th century? Someone I mentioned this in the past somewhere. What? Ben-Gurion, precisely. He models himself on Uzziah. In particular, he built towers in the desert. The idea of building up the Negev was something that Ben-Gurion modeled on Uzziah. He sounds great. He's expanding. He's building up the land. And then you take a look at source number 12. Still describing Uzziah. And in Jerusalem, he made engines invented by skillful men to be on the towers and upon the bulwarks to shoot arrows and great stones. And his name spread far abroad, for he was marvelously held until he was strong. But when he was strong, his heart was lifted up to his destruction. For he transgressed against the Lord his God and went into the temple of the Lord to burn incense upon the altar of incense. And as for Yahweh, the priest went after him, and with him 80 priests of the Lord, who were men of valor, and they withstood Uzziah the king, and said to him, "It's not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Go out of the sanctuary, for you have trespassed. It shall not be for your honor from the Lord God." And then Uzziah was angry. He had a censer in his hand to burn incense. And while he was angry with the priests, that Saran took it out on his forehead before the priests in the house of the Lord, Saran being laid beside the incense altar. And Azariah, the chief priest, and all the priests looked upon him, and behold, he was diseased in his forehead. They thrust him outwardly from there, and he himself hastened to go out because the Lord had struck him. And Uzziah the king was afflicted with Saran to the day of his death, and dwelt in the house of separation, being diseased. He was cut off from the house of the Lord, and no son of his son was over the king's house, judging the people of the land. So here you have somebody who is described as being righteous. Somebody who comes from the big wine. Somebody who builds up the land and does all sorts of wonderful things. But in his arrogance, he overreaches. And the anti-Zionists look at the people building up the state and say, it's Lucia who's going up. This is what they are doing now in their day. But it doesn't stop with Lucy Young. There's another model. And this brings me back closer to what Diane was talking about. And that is a story that's relevant since time has come out in 3 weeks. And this is the story of the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans. We're familiar with the basic story, right? The Greeks control the region. There are Jews who have become Hellenized and joined the Greeks. The temple itself has been converted to a house of worship for the Greeks. They bring a pig as an offering. And the Maccabees say, we're not going to take this. And in fact, we're going to fight back. And they fight a war of rebellion. And the rest is history. Except there's more to the story. Because what happens after they have fought off the Greeks? Who takes charge? No,
their descendants.
The descendants of the Hashmonaim, the descendants of the Hasmoneans take charge. Ultimately, the Romans are brought in. Unfortunately, this is the classic story of Jews being the architect of our own demise. Right? You know how it is that the Romans get involved?
They're invited.
We invite them in. Because there was a battle between two houses among the descendants of the Hasmoneans, and we go looking for allies. And somebody said, oh, those Romans, those would be good allies. Right? Who thought that was a good idea? And then that just gives them an entrance for political influence and ultimately to take over. But going back before that time, the Hasmoneans themselves take charge. And look what happens. Look at source number 13, please. This is talking about Shimon, one of the Maccabees. The people therefore sang the acts of Shimon, and of what glory he fought to bring his nation, made him their governor and chief priest, because he had done all these things, and for the justice and faith which he kept to his nation, and for that he sought by all means to exalt his people. For in his time things prospered in his hands. King Demetrius, the Greek, also confirmed him in the high priesthood according to those things, and made him one of his friends, and honored him with great honor. For he had heard say that the Romans had called the Jews their friends and confederates and brethren, and that they had entertained the ambassadors of Simon honorably. Also that the Jews and priests were well pleased that Simon should be their governor and high priest forever until there should arise a faithful prophet. Moreover, that he should be their captain, explaining why the Greeks supported the elevation of Shimon and Simon as the high priest and as the governor. It's because, number one, they wanted to defeat Roman influence, and number two, because they saw that the Jews approved of Shimon, they approved of Simon. But keep on reading. I'm jumping towards the end there. Also, that it should be, these are the rules that he made. Actually, jumping before that. Beside this, is what I meant, five by up before the end of the source. Beside this, the decree is that he should be obeyed of every man. All the writings of the country should be made in his name, and that he should be clothed in purple and wear gold. Also, that it should be lawful for none of the people or priests to break any of these things, or to gainsay his words, or to gather an assembly in the country without him, or to be clothed in purple or wear a buckle of gold. And whosoever should do otherwise or break any of these things, he should be punished. What's the purple and gold?
Royalty.
Royalty, but who decided that that was royalty? Is that one of our practices?
No.
No, that was Greek. The Hashmonaim and Hasmoneans who fought off the Hellenist influence themselves became Hellenized. They adopted the trappings of the Greeks. It's another example of what can happen when you create a state, but become so enamored with what you created that you abandon the principles that brought you there. Take a look at source number 14, right? Moses Nachmanides, writing in the 13th century, says the following. He talks about a different problem with the Hasmoneans. The Hasmoneans were covenant. They were priests from the tribe of Levi. Kings of Israel were supposed to be from what tribe? Judah, not the tribe of Levi. What they did was they took the religious authority of being from the tribe of Levi and the political authority that belonged to the tribe of Judah and arrogated both for themselves. So Nachmanides writes, in my opinion, the kings from other tribes who raided after David violated the wishes of their ancestors, switching the lots of tribes, kingdom continued to carpet king after king from other tribes without returning to the monarchy of Judah. They violated the command. This was the reason for the punishment of the Hasmoneans who raided the second temple. They were pious servants of God, and without them the Torah and commandments would have been forgotten from Israel, but they received a great punishment as the four sons of the elder Hasmonean who reigned in succession with all their might and success fell by the sword of their enemies. And it's also possible their sin in reigning was because they were Kohen, they were priests, they were not supposed to rule. And they were commanded to guard their priesthood for all matters of the altar and serve and so on. Their job was to serve as priests, not to take the throne. As a matter of fact, for those who have some knowledge of Talmud, where does the Talmud discuss the laws of the Sabbath? What volume? Shabbat. Right, that was easy. Where does the Talmud discuss the laws of Passover? Sakim. Where does it discuss the laws of Purim? In Megillah, the Bible of Megillah. Where does the Talmud discuss the laws of Hanukkah? It does not appear in the Mishnah. The Mishnah, the core text on which the Talmud is developed, does not have any dedicated section at all for the laws of Hanukkah. It actually makes it into the laws of Shin, into the Talmud's discussion of Shabbat. Because when the Talmud has a discussion, the Mishnah has a discussion about which fuels and which wicks you're allowed to use for Shabbat candles, it then goes into a discussion about which things to use for Hanukkah candles. But there's no dedicated section. It is reported in the name of Rabbi Moshe Silver and Chatam Sofer that he argued that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the canonizer of the Mishnah, omitted the status of Hanukkah from the Mishnah when he canonized it because of what the Hashemite had done, because it has been eaten to power and became corrupt. There's more to it. There's a lot to say whether Rabbi Silver actually said that, what he actually said. It's a longer discussion. He gets quoted by different people as saying different things. But the very fact that you have the idea that what is considered such a wonderful holiday and an important mitzvah could be omitted from the Mishnah because of what they did tells you the suspicion and fear involved that we become enamored of our own creations and forget the God who's supposed to be credited for it. Yes, Thomas.
So for what else in the in time is there Alevasi?
Al-Nisim is ancient. It's a couple of thousand years old. Al-Nisim is ancient. Let me make sure I'm clear here. No one argues for ending the celebration of Hanukkah. And no one argues for ending like lighting the menorah and saying Al-Nisim and Tefillah and all of that. But they're arguing for playing it down. As a matter of fact, if you look at your sheet, I quoted in source number 13, the Book of Maccabees. The Book of Maccabees tells the story of Hanukkah. It's not found in Tanakh, it's not found in the Hebrew Bible. Why didn't they make it into the Hebrew Bible? So some argue, very correct, but some make the argument that it was omitted from the Hebrew Bible because, again, because of where things went at the end, because of what the descendants of Hashemite did. The reason I say they're wrong is because historically it was too late, it's post-canonization work. But nonetheless, that's the argument that's made. And it's just the fact that people make the argument says something. But going back to where we were with this, I brought you source number 15. This was a popular slogan after the Six-Day War in 1967. It doesn't translate well. That's why I left it in Hebrew. It is called HaKavod LaTzahal. I guess you can translate it as all honor to the IDF. But the idea is that Kol HaKavod should be Kol HaKavod LaShem, all honor to God, and instead it's all honor to the IDF. And it is held up as an example of people having fallen into the trap that we were warned about in Chumash. The trap that Uziyahu fell into. The trap that the Hasmoneans fell into. And so if you take a look at source number 16, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, also known as the Sabra Rebbe in the middle of the 20th century, he says, "This has been the way of the Zionists from the beginning. Regarding all of their impropriety in the Holy Land, they say it is a product of love of the land. Regarding any who disagree with their nullification of religion in the Holy Land, they cry out that he is a hater of Zion and a hater of the land. They claim that we are anti-Zionists and so on. It is not so. We are anti what they have created," is what he's trying to say. But take a look now at number 17. This is from a response in dealing with the question of saying Hallel, to praise God on Yom Yerushalayim, the anniversary of the Six-Day War. So, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum is against the idea of saying Hallel on that day. Now you'll say, how can you be against it? It's praising God for the fact that we received Jerusalem again. It's praising God for the fact that we survived what would have been, you know, horrible massacre. Take a look at 17. He says, "And certainly, those who praise the miracles of the wicked, even if their intent is to praise the Creator, they contradict and deny the divine power to perform open and true miracles, saying explicitly that biblical miracles are the same as the Six-Day War, and so are the miracles of the Exodus from Egypt. They deny the miracles of God. This is entirely heretical." What's he saying? Unpack this. What is he saying is going on?
They're claiming.
Yeah.
Something that was done by God. Something that was man-made.
Well, either man-made, which says that they're equating the miracles of God and biblically with miracles engineered by man. What he's saying is that the miracles that occurred during the Six-Day War, in anything, if they're miraculous at all, they are miracles engineered through the acts of human beings. They're not open and explicit miracles, and then people are saying that that's not the same thing as the miracles that are biblical, and they're denying that God can alter nature, that God can make the sun stop, that God can make the sea split. He says what they've experienced is leading them to what he considers to be heresy. That's his name. He continues. He says, "And I have seen another stumbling block in that ruling to recite Hallel on the anniversary of the Six-Day War. For if, God forbid, that would be accepted, people of little faith could easily come to contradict entirely one of the principles of faith in the arrival of Mashiach speedily in our days." So the Messiah's already here. We've already achieved and we've already received everything. So that's another reason for rejection of Zionism, and in fact, anti-Zionism. One step further, and this is a very hard passage to read, yes?
Soul group that will know when the
Galileo for a Seneca report?
Yes. They absolutely do.
Those men involved miracles are okay.
Yes. I may go into wine, but yes. But they're not done with this. That's not the last of the arguments. You already presented three arguments. Here's the fourth. Fear of what these new Zionists are going to do to Jewish life in Israel. And this is both financial and religious. Remember that for centuries, Jewish life in Israel was subsidized by money that was sent from Jewish communities elsewhere. The Sephardic Jews in Israel, before you get to the more modern way of Ashkenazi Aliyah, are supported by funds sent by Jews elsewhere. There's a whole discussion in rabbinic writing about prioritizing your tzedakah and whether you should prioritize support for Jews living in Israel as opposed to Jews living in other places because we want there to be a Jewish community there. And then the Ashkenazi come, the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th, and they have their held up. They have their distribution of funds that they're collecting in Europe. Well, not everybody thought that this Halukha was a good thing. And those who were supported by it wanted it. But the Zionists came along and said, this is welfare, and this is bad for our community, because we should be building on the land, not living off the support of European Jewry. Take a look at your sheets, verse number 19. And you get a whole. By making it possible for the inhabitants of Jerusalem to gain a livelihood in a dignified way through the work of their own hands, Bezalel, the art institute that was created, is helping to undermine the evil influence of the Halukah. It is developing a new sense of independence in the old settlement. Right? She's calling their system of survival evil. Take a look at number 20. Rabbi Nachman Eliezer ben Yehuda. Feels offensive to read something from the Ezra Yehuda in English instead of in Hebrew. Nonetheless, he says, talking about the Halukah, there were other authors as well who also spoke negatively regarding the Halukah, not because of its sin against the Enlightenment, but because they saw it in the origin of every ruinous trait they identified with the Jewish residents of this land, saying that it caused the Jewish residents of Eretz Israel to be weak, to listen to falsehood, to be idle all day, and to not desire any labor. So here you have a community, religious community, that's being supported by this, and in come the Zionists and say, we want to put an end to that. We want people to move out, we want people to start farming, we want people to develop the land, and to become self-sufficient. It's a threat. Right or wrong isn't my point. My point is that that is a powerful force for the anti-Zionists. They look at this and say, you're trying to uproot our means of survival in the land, calling it evil. But it's not just about finances. It's also about religion and what they're going to do to the practice of religion in the state of Israel. Now, in the early stage, you have the big fights over the drafting of Yeshiva students, who is a Jew, well, fine, it's not just the early state. But you find the status quo agreement that Ben Gurion agrees to with the religious groups, in which he says certain things will continue to be controlled by religious parties in Israel, because Ben Gurion thinks to himself, he'll be gone soon. Right? He was not a prophet. But this is an ongoing issue that absolutely needs to strike, and it's not only about control. It's not only about who gets to say what's going to happen in the land as a whole. It's about who says what I can do personally. Because the fear is that the Zionists are going to come along and are going to outlaw practice of religion by people who are themselves religious. And you're going to say, well, that's extreme. But take a look at verse number 21. Piece of an essay by Daphne Barak-Harris, Civil Rights and Privatization in Israel. She's talking about the issue of, well, you'll see it here, but the issue of the application of civil rights to private businesses, to private organizations. You know, we have certain rules in Canada, just like they do in, you know, many countries, that protect against discrimination of various kinds. Do those rules apply to private individuals? In other words, If I'm selling my home, am I allowed to say, I want to sell it to so-and-so because of his race? No, I'm not allowed to do so. Sorry?
Not now.
Now, I'm talking about now. I'm talking about now. On the other hand, there are other rights which only apply in one's relationship with the government, not in one's relationship with a private person or a private organization. So for example, freedom of speech. The government is not allowed to suppress my speech. But if you come into my house and I say, there are things I don't want you to say, am I violating your right to free speech?
No.
No. My house. I'm entitled to decide what's going to be said. However, there is a wave in Europe that has been building for at least the last 20 years, a legislative wave, that wants to apply all civil rights, not only on the government level, but also to private businesses and to private people, to be able to say, you can't do something that oversteps versus private rights. And it exists also in Canada, you should know. It's not something that's foreign to Canada as well. Canada's trying to follow Europe in this regard. It's a longer discussion. But take a look at source number 21 now. The first alternative, arguing for the application of civil rights to privatized enterprises, this is talking in Israel, rests on a growing willingness to disregard the public-private distinction and abandon the traditional view limiting civil rights to citizen-government relationships. These developments have started to have an impact on Israeli law as well, as exemplified mainly in the decisions and academic writings of Justice Aharon Barak. In the famous Castamount case, and how famous it is here, Justice Barak considered the possibility of applying civil rights to a local burial society which denied rights to relatives of a deceased person. They wanted to write something on the headstone. The burial society has certain rules for what could or could not be written on headstones within the cemetery, and the argument was freedom of speech. They should be able to write whatever they want on the headstone. That's the idea. So what happens is, a government comes in and creates rules which are not religious or not respectful of religion or even are against it. And then that rule is that it will be applied to what I do in private. This is an issue worldwide. This is not an Israel issue. Right? Some of you were in a class a couple of years ago where I quoted a case that actually came up in Europe. It was a Muslim family who did not want to have their daughter swim co-ed. The public school system required that they go swim in, and when they argued that they didn't want to go swimming in that environment because it was a mixed environment, the government said, too bad. You're required, indeed. You want to send your kids to the public school system, your kids have to be engaged in this co-ed activity. That's part of it. You don't have the right to opt out. So, that's something that goes on, and that's an issue worldwide. But the anti-Zionists are very concerned about how this is going to impact on them. I brought you a couple of examples here on the sheet. Just want to see the time. Okay, I see the time. So, we're going to just talk about it briefly. I'm jumping the other examples that I brought on the sheet just to show you the verses that I bring here. In sources 24, 25, well, 24 speaks about the obligation of tochacha to educate others about wrongdoing, and source number 25 speaks about the importance of the government in Israel, in this case the king, to actually keep a Torah scroll with him in order to observe the laws of the Torah. And if you flip the page to 26, this is the passage that is the origin of the term Neturei Karta, the passage from the Jerusalem Talmud, in which the Talmud itself talks about the teachers and students as the true guardians of the city, the people who will guard the practice of Judaism. So we have four factors so far for the anti-Zionists. Number one, we're not supposed to be the ones who are going to lead the charge back. It waits for God. Number two, concentrating Jews in Israel is dangerous, and don't tell me that God is going to take care of us. Number three, disapproval of admiration of the state and the potential arrogance that comes with it. And number four, fear of what the new Zionists will do to Jewish life financially and religiously in Israel. The last point that I brought here is the issue of partnership. The idea that religiously it is wrong to partner with those who are engaged in unholy activities. And I brought you source number 27 as an example of that. There's a story which requires time in its own right to explain. You know what? I'm going to go to 28 instead. It will be easier. 28 is the description of that war I mentioned before, the war that partners the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom. And the king of the Southern Kingdom is punished for partnering with the Northern Kingdom. If you see the quote in number 28, they partnered to make boats to travel to Tarshish. They made the boats in Ezion Geber. Eliezer, son of the Davahu of Mareshah, prophesied upon Yehoshaphat, when you joined with Ahaziah, the king of the north, God destroyed your deeds. The ships were smashed and were not able to travel to Tarsus. You're not supposed to join with somebody who is engaged in wrong behavior, which brought in Perkeavot in source number 29. That's not a Jewish idea exclusively. I brought you the rule from CPA Ontario about being responsible to make sure, if you're a CPA, that the people you work with also honor the rules, even if they're not members of the accounting society. But take a look at source number 31. Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman was killed in the Holocaust. Writes this letter in 1934. It is known to all that the heads of this organization, the Hestadrut, has set a goal of uprooting the Torah from its root with a mighty hand and educating and raising a new nation of Israel in place of the old nation of Israel. It is clear that one may not join with them in any sort of union. Even living in their neighborhood is prohibited. So far, he wants to go with this. And it gets cited in anti-Zionist writing, like the Neturei Karta on participating in the elections, in source number 32. They will not participate in the elections. So, what we've seen, hopefully, over the course of the 3 weeks, many different kinds of Zionism, political, cultural, spiritual, messianic, religious, all anchored in biblical text. The A-Zionists, the people who say, well, there's no mitzvah for me to go develop a land, or it's not time, I'm not going to go until the Messiah comes, or I'm afraid of false messiahs, therefore I don't want to encourage it. And we've seen the anti-Zionists and their fears of what will happen to religious life in the land, their fears of arrogance, and so on. I'm not going to go through everything that we said today. But all of them anchoring themselves in biblical text, right or wrong, each group has to figure it out. But take a look at number 33, please, because the only way to end a series like this is with a quote from Rabbi Cook. Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook, chief rabbi of the state of Israel, Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the state of Israel, under the British mandate. If at a certain time there should be found an arousal whereby people will speak only of the spirit of the nation and will attempt to negate the spirit of God, what should the righteous of the generation do? To rebel against the spirit of the nation, even verbally, and to reject its assets, this is something impossible. The spirit of the Lord and the spirit of Israel are one. So when people come along and say, we're nationalists, I don't mean it that way. This way. And we're not religious. He says, I'm not willing to negate that drive. Rather, the righteous must work hard to reveal the light and the holiness in the national spirit. And that's his vision, ultimately, of people finding a way to be able to work together to build up the land of Israel. Thank you so much.